Perfect. Now I have your number. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man.
Hey everybody, welcome back. We've got a very special guest, Blake D. Bauer, who is the author of the international best-selling book, You Were Not Born to Suffer. The book's been translated into 10 languages, and I'm really excited to have Blake here to talk about all sorts of different modalities. He helps people who cannot find effective support from conventional psychology, medicine, or religion. And he's a world-renowned teacher and speaker, extensive background in psychology, alternative medicine, nutrition, traditional healing, mindfulness meditation, which I like to talk about a lot on the show. So really excited to have you here, man. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Robbie. Happy to be here.
So tell us your story. From the digging I've done to prepare myself for the interview, you have a really interesting story, and saw some very cool videos and interviews about overcoming addiction, those sorts of things. So yeah, give us you know how you got here.
Well, that is obviously a loaded question, and I'm gonna try and keep it succinct. So if I ramble, you feel free to cut me off at any point, or you know, ask me anything you want. But, sure. I grew up like a lot of people in a dysfunctional family around, you know, people who were not healthy, and they couldn't teach me how to be healthy. And then I developed a lot of self-destructive behaviors to cope with my thoughts and my emotions and my pain that I never learned how to talk about. And then also just to survive socially as a kid in school, as a teenager. So I started to smoke pot and drink, you know, socially and with friends at a young age, probably around 12, and was introduced to things at a young age because I had family members that were addicted to drugs and into partying and self-destructive in some of those ways. And then I got heavier and heavier into drinking and getting high and exploring all different kinds of drugs. And, you know, I think I was searching to feel better than I felt and trying to numb my pain and numb those voices in my head that I didn't know how to talk about or explore in a healthy way. And so by the time I was 18 years old, I had been arrested a number of times for drug possession. I got to the point where I was selling pot and selling pills that I was taking on a regular basis. I also played sports growing up, which was an outlet for me and part of my identity. And I was the captain of the varsity football team with two of my best friends in high school and had offers to play, you know, college football. And at that point thought I was invincible and was very self-destructive. And then one night I got a very bad DUI in the middle of the night. I was like 3 o'clock in the morning coming home from a night of partying and had taken a bunch of pills and drank, you know, at that age, I could just drink and drink and drink. I've been drinking all night and smoking all night. And so I got to a freight train in the middle of the night and I was just delirious and could hardly keep my eyes open. And so I was parked right in front of the guardrail, the tracks. And I thankfully had put my car in park. I put my head back and I fell asleep and I woke up to police knocking on the window and I didn't know what was going on. And I rolled down the window and I said to the officer, "Excuse me, officer, am I driving too slow?" And he says, "Son, you've been parked here for at least an hour. We got a call from this house. There's a car parked at the train tracks with the lights on, car running." And so anyway, so I was arrested. I got a pretty bad DUI. I had possession of all those substances with me, and my coach found out. I got kicked off the team, had to resign as captain, was like shamed in front of my best friends in the community. And so I went from having this big ego and thinking I was invincible and pretty arrogant probably to being just devastated. I like my whole world just crumbled very quickly and no one was to blame but myself. But obviously at the time I couldn't see or think clearly about anything. And so I found myself just spiraling deeper and darker downhill, and was waking up every day very tortured mentally and emotionally. And it's 18 and we're getting ready to, you know, finish high school and then figure out what's that next step. And I'm sure, as you could relate, there's a lot of pressure at that point in time to figure out, you know, what am I going to do with my life? Do I go to work? If so, what do I do to make money, to make a living? You know, am I going to go to college or university? Am I going to study? If so, what am I going to study? What am I supposed to be? There's just, you know, all these different, you know, social and cultural and familial pressures. And then I was someone who was quite hard on myself and put a lot of pressure on myself as well. And so I just was absolutely confused and lost. And I felt like all my friends and my peers were just kind of drifting and were just kind of okay going with the next step. But I really had no idea anymore who I was or what I wanted to do with my life. And it was waking.
That's such a crazy time to have all of that stuff happen. Like, you're a senior in high school at this point, right? And
yeah,
that's your entire identity. You know, you're captain of the football team. You're, you know, like, you're the man. And then all of a sudden for that to be taken away, I can only imagine how, I mean, it's like a death sentence for someone in your shoes. So that's sorry to cut you off. It's just I can't even imagine that happening. Like, cause I was also an athlete. Captain of the golf team, not quite as popular, but
no, it's okay. One of my best friends was a golfer too. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
If that was taken away from me as a senior in high school, I don't know what I'd do. I'd probably, who knows? So crazy.
Yeah. I'm surprised I didn't. I mean, I think, so I came from a lot of drug addiction and I have people in my family who overdosed and, you know, had successful lives and beautiful families and ruined everything. So I think if I hadn't had that as an example of what I didn't want,
right,
I could have spiraled further downhill, but something thankfully kicked in inside of me. And I think it was a combination of my ego and my pride that I had this feeling inside of me that I didn't want to end up like them. I had too much self-respect and I already felt so ashamed of myself that I had screwed everything up. And so that gave me this strength to stop drinking, to stop getting high. And I really was abusing all of these substances, but got clean on my own at 18 going on 19. And the reason why was because I was in so much pain. I mean, I'm sure you can relate to those times in your life when you wake up and you're tortured mentally and emotionally, you feel confused and anxious and you don't have clarity and you don't trust yourself yet. And you don't trust life yet. And you don't trust the universe yet. And you just don't know what to do. And you're overwhelmed by all these thoughts and emotions and you don't even know how to talk about it. And so here I am at 18 coming off of drug and alcohol abuse, just flooded and overwhelmed with these negative thoughts and anxiety and insecurity and confusion and self-hatred for making all the mistakes I had just made. And I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. And so, so basically I was waking up every day with this feeling of, you know, life is not meant to be so painful. So how do I free myself from this suffering? There has to be a way out. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of that suffering was life can't just be about making money and doing what everybody else is doing. Cause I had grown up around people who had chased wealth and found it, lost it, fucked everything up, ruined their families, you know? So I'd grown up around, you know, fluctuations in money and people who had really toxic relationships to money. And I had toxic relationships to money, even as a young person, when I look back and I reflect on it. And so I knew that, you know, money wasn't the key to happiness and success, but yet I didn't know what else was the key to happiness and success. So I felt like I had to have some kind of purpose for being here, but I had no idea what that was. And here I am tortured mentally and emotionally, and I have no idea what to do with that. So these two questions drove me forward at 18, you know, how do I free myself from my suffering and what's the purpose of my life? What am I doing here? What am I supposed to do with my life? Cause I never had like, oh, I want to be a doctor. Or I want to be a teacher or I want to be I want to be this, you know,
not even a football player.
It wasn't like, I mean, I knew that was just, you know, part of that chapter of life, but I mean, I knew I wasn't going pro. I didn't think I was going to be, you know, making a living playing football.
Right.
So, you know, I'm a 5'11 white guy, you know, I was strong, you know, but and fast, but no, I don't think I was that good.
Yeah.
So Yeah, that never, that was never on the table for me. But so basically, it's a long story, but from 18 onward, I just became like, I was like this sick animal. And I just, the only thing I cared about was healing and figuring out everything, figuring out the purpose of life, the universe, God, what is this thing we call life? And so that journey took me to 5 different universities. I studied with spiritual teachers from around the world in yoga, meditation, Tai Chi, Qigong, natural healing. You know, I read hundreds and probably thousands of books, like probably you and most people, on spirituality and God and meditation and nutrition and philosophy and self-help, and just trying to figure out how to change your life, how to have a good life, how to improve the quality of your life, your relationships, your health. And that journey just led me to a series of realizations where I could see that my entire healing, spiritual, and personal development journey was all me learning how to love myself. And my training showed me how us never learning how to love ourselves as children, so never learning how to take care of our mind, never learning how to take care of our heart and our emotions, never learning how to take care of our physical body in a healthy, you know, balanced, proper way, actually causes all forms of disease and depression in the body. So I had this epiphany where I could see how the immune system breaks down from internalizing your emotions and from negative thinking and the toxic habits and relationships that come from that process and the toxic choices you make when you don't have a healthy relationship to your thoughts and your emotions. And I was very young and innocent, and I just thought to myself, I just want to help as many people as I could, because I was desperate to have this type of clarity. And I thought, there's got to be a lot of other people that are as desperate as me, but they're not talking about it. And so that's when I had this idea to write my book. I was 24 years old, and I started pitching it, trying to get an agent, trying to get a publisher at 24. And I got rejected over 100 times because everybody's looking at me as this 24-year-old kid. Like, how could he have any kind of wisdom or know what he's talking about? Right. And meanwhile, I had lived like a monk from 18 to 24, you know, just trying to heal, just trying to, you know, train my mind, heal all the emotional pain. So that's a good question. I'm going to come back to that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. So anyway, so it was just this pure desire in my heart, you know, was just to help as many. I was naive, you know, very naive. I just wanted to help as many people as I could. So during those years, I worked in a natural medicine pharmacy selling vitamins and supplements and Chinese herbs just to be around the industry.
There was a place like that in Marina Del Rey, right where I used to live.
Okay. Was it called Pharmaca by chance?
No, it was like Dr. Someone's. I'm sure you've probably heard of it, but it's like a huge, people came from everywhere to check this place out for all the different sort of healing stuff they had. And
oh, cool.
Marina Del Rey is a very big kind of spirituality community, as you know. So,
yeah beautiful. So, yes. Yeah. So I gravitated towards a place like that because I enjoyed working with, you know, the people who worked there were naturopaths and acupuncturists. And so I learned from everybody I worked with. And then I worked for a Chinese medicine doctor. You know, he's here in Chicago, a 7th generation master herbalist who's also an oncologist. And I just got lucky, and he was looking to open an office in the area I grew up in. And so I got to manage his practice and, you know, merge what I was studying with, you know, paying some bills. So, I mean, I did other things during the year, those years too, but those were the primary yeah. things.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so that desire to get this idea out there to help people to learn how to love themselves was so strong, because I realized that all the mistakes I had made, all the pain I had caused myself was all because I didn't know how to love myself. I didn't know how to value myself. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't know how to talk about my emotions and talk about my thoughts. And so I just wanted to help as many people as I could, you know, have this clarity, so you don't have to stay trapped in your suffering and these situations that you create as a result, because you don't know how to get out of it.
Totally. I mean, that's a huge problem I see with my clients, probably a lot of listeners to the show. You know, as guys, we're not really taught how to process our emotions, how to talk about our emotions, really how to do anything with our emotions. We're just kind of taught, like, you know, don't be a pussy or don't be like a wimp, like just get over it, be tough, you know, don't talk about it, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So yeah, if you, you know, throughout our discussion, if you have any ways that guys can sort of move past that and find a way to kind of healthily express, you know, and I wanted to circle back, I guess, before you answer that. One way that I actually found to be really helpful, but also a kind of a problem, was using MDMA. And I wanted to get your kind of take on that, being someone who was, you know, once addicted to substances. Because when I was about, I don't know, in my early 30s, I started experimenting with MDMA. And I was like, oh my God, it's like unleashing this totally different sort of part in my brain where I can just completely connect with my emotions and connect with other people so much faster. So probably used it and abused it way too much, had a lot of fun, but I had never experimented with drugs at all up until, you know, about the age of 31. So, you know, and when I was in high school, when I was 18, you know, I wasn't going to parties. I was just a total golf dork. You know, no girlfriends, no nothing, just basically golf, study, you know, rinse, repeat. So, you know, the idea, like, you know, it wasn't until much later where I started experimenting with drugs, and then it became a little bit of a problem. So,
totally.
Yeah. But so as like an 18-year-old, you know, captain of the football team, you know, from a social standpoint, you're like at the very top of the food chain there.
I don't know. I mean, I loved my friends. I loved, you know, I think back on those years, I often very fondly. You know, I had so much fun, and I was kind of like a rebel without a cause. You know, I didn't follow the rules. I, you know, just wanted to do things on my terms, and yeah, was always a good person, but just didn't follow, you know, the rules. So, mm-hmm, you know, quote unquote. And I loved my friends, and I loved my girlfriend at the time, or, you know, and those were good years. I feel like they were the only time in my life that I like didn't have any worries. And, but the shadow side, the dark side of that, was that I actually did have a lot of pain, and I was just running from it and numbing it until I hit a brick wall.
Using drugs to numb it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was my, you know, and at that age, and this is a theme that most of us grapple with, you know, our whole lives, coming back to self-love, you know, I didn't love and accept myself 100%. So I was seeking acceptance and approval and to fit in and to belong externally. Mm-hmm. And so part of that process is the things you do that you might not do had you had a really healthy sense of self, which I did not have. And so, right, you know, I drank more because I wanted to be accepted. I did more drugs because I wanted to be more, you know, accepted. I probably took more risks because I wanted to be respected, you know, all right, these, but that was coming from probably a deeper insecurity and lack of self-acceptance.
Totally. So, yeah. And that's kind of how I felt on the MDMA.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, when I was, you know, high, like all of those feelings of I don't fit in, you know, this girl I'm hitting on is going to see that I'm a fraud, like all that shit just went away. And I just felt self-love. But obviously, that's not a healthy way to get there, or at least it's maybe in the future, there'll be a way that's more healthy to do it. But certainly not popping a pill in a nightclub is probably the way to go.
Well, we live and we learn, you know. I mean, I'm a big believer in, you know, you got to learn, because if you don't really learn the lesson, it's looming in your soul, or you have to learn that lesson. So it's like, you know, it's like you want the chocolate cake, fine, have the chocolate cake, eat the whole fucking cake until you make yourself sick, and then you realize, you know, I don't really need all that chocolate cake. Like, right, you know, like the bite was like enough. That was enough, you know? So for me, my greatest wisdom has come from that, from learning things on my own, the hard way. And so, yeah, I think, there's no shame. You know, we come, I think also part of just this conversation we're having is that in our culture, the modern Western developed world, we don't have any healthy forms of initiation. And in tribal ancient cultures, you know, there was this initiation for how boys became men and girls became women. You know, we would go out and we would do vision, you know, quests and fast, and we would learn to hunt with our elders and things like that. And the women would have their forms of initiation. And I think that there's a part of our deep subconscious, our like primitive soul, that craves initiation into adulthood. But we live in this time that's so disconnected from nature, so disconnected from our true nature, and this capitalistic rat race that we're supposed to transition into is so unnatural and so unhealthy and so toxic that we find these other ways to initiate ourselves into something bigger. So we do drugs to open our mind, or we travel, or, you know, whatever we do some, it's like we find a way to wake ourselves up because we know that this like cold comfort of this like corporate life and trying to find a job and fit in the system, there's more to life than that. And I actually think a lot of our that like drive towards taking risk, towards drugs, is a symptom of not having healthy forms of initiation in our culture today.
Yeah, that's a really good point. My little brother, I'm 38, he's 23. He just graduated college. And it's like for him and all of his friends, I kind of remember where I was at 22, you know, like what the hell am I supposed to do now? Like get a job working in an office, do something I hate. Like, you know, you go through, you know, you pay all this money for university, you go through high school, you do all these things. And then at the end of that road, you're just like, what the fuck do I do now? Like, and there's like no real choice, you know, especially now given the crazy times with Corona, kids trying to get jobs these days. You know, like there's no initiation that prepares you really for anything, because all that school, all the money just spent on university, like that sometimes you get a job, it doesn't help you figure out who you are. It doesn't really do anything lot of the time. Hopefully if you've had some cool experiences, you know, living on your own, the people you meet, the friendships you have, maybe being in a frat or a sorority, you kind of have some of those initiation sort of things, but that's a huge missing piece, you know, that you brought up. And I think that's why a lot of people probably turn to substances or whatever, because that's totally missing in our culture.
Totally. Sure.
Yeah.
And then going full circle to kind of where the question began, you know, I was someone who did drugs every day and often all day for years, and then got totally sober and clean, and then became addicted to practices like meditation and yoga and Qigong, and have now spent years and days and weeks, you know, like hours every day practicing these practices. And I have a very intense personality. And so I became very addicted to meditation when I found it, because it was the only thing that helped me. It helped me more than reading anything. It helped me more than yoga did, for example. It helped me just more than anything. So I was like, this is it. This works. This is actually giving me relief from my suffering. So I'm going to keep doing this. And so I became very addicted to it. And so I often tell people that I have experienced such amazing highs and states of consciousness that are sustainable and sometimes hard to put into words, although I can put them into words for us in this conversation, that they far surpass the quality of any high I had on any substance. And because to know that you can reach these states of consciousness without depending on anything external to you. And then also there's a part of us that always knows when we take something like a pill or some kind of drug, for a lot of us, we're not at peace with that relationship. There's a little bit of shame. There's a little bit of guilt. There's a little bit of fear. There's a little bit of judgment. A lot of people struggle with that in themselves, even if they like it and they think it's okay. right. there's still subtle remnants of those energies, of those emotions and thoughts and vibrations in that relationship.
Yeah.
And so it's really pure and really healthy when it's like the metaphor of, you know, it's like you get a car, but nobody teaches you how to drive the car, right? You don't read the manual, or you don't take driver's school, or you don't really have any kind of guidance. Our body's like that. It's like there are these ways of using our being, so our thoughts, our emotion, our body, that are so powerful and so effective and so easy and so empowering, but they're not the things we learn at school. You know, like in my mind, we should be learning nutrition at school and meditation at school and maybe yoga, like how to, you know, stretch and really take care of our body in an unaggressive, you know, as a football player, for example, I learned a very aggressive relationship to my body, you know, lifting too much weight, all ego, you know, hurting myself instead of really taking care of myself. And that's a symptom of our culture, you know, of where we're at today. But so I grew, you know, I had an older brother who introduced me to drugs at a very young age. He died in 2013 from a heroin overdose. I had an aunt and an uncle who were both drug addicts, both died very young because of drugs. I have my biological father has struggled with drug addiction his whole life. So you're talking to someone who I don't judge because I come from it. I did it. I've seen it all. And so that's part of the efficacy of my work is people can tell I don't judge, but I'm going to tell you how it is. I'm not going to beat around the bush. It's like, you're probably numbing out. You're probably not taking responsibility for your feelings and your thoughts. And this is an excuse. It's a band-aid. It's a pastime. You're delaying, you know, avoiding what you really need to get to. And I think one of the things is we're avoiding our purpose, right? Because that deep sense of purpose for understanding like who we are, why we're here. And when you get to that part of yourself, your vibration, your energy rises and you get stronger and stronger and stronger. And so you don't want to take anything that's going to bring your vibration down. And so often we think, right, the drug or the substance brings our vibration up, but that's not true. It's very temporary. It's just chemical. But like, you know, when you start eating healthy and you start exercising, you start meditating, you start training your mind and you start feeling good and you have felt like shit, you're not going to want anything to take that away from you anymore. You know, it's like you eat the fried, you know, buffalo chicken pizza and you're like, it was good, but is it worth the suffering afterwards? You know, is it worth it? You know,
it's that short term, you know,
exactly
like high, but then it's a long term. And that's exactly how I felt after a few years being in the party scene, you know, doing too much coke, too much Molly. You know, I felt just kind of drained after. Almost exactly as you describe it. And it was kind of around that time I started meditating as well. But I was never able to get to those levels of consciousness that ever sort of, you know, equaled or surpassed the feeling that I would get on drugs. One of my best friends, was also a pretty heavy drug user. And then he started meditating. And he said almost verbatim what you just said about, he's like, the high I experienced from meditation is nothing like, it's so much better and different than what I ever experienced on drugs. So what was that journey like for you?
In discovering meditation?
Mm-hmm.
Well, ultimately a blessing, like, mm-hmm. Meditation saved my life because there were a lot of times where I struggled with suicidal thoughts and I didn't even want to be here because my psychological and emotional pain was so intense. So meditation really saved my life. So it was so empowering the meditation I teach comes from what the Buddha taught. And it's really the foundation for any type of meditation, specifically like Zen, mindfulness, the things that have become really popular.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you sit there with your eyes closed and you focus on your breathing and your body. And whenever you start to think about anything or anyone or have a conversation with yourself, the voices in your head, you say the word thinking. And when you say the word thinking, you're just objectively labeling the fact that you were thinking about whatever. And then that's your cue to bring your attention back to your breathing and back to your body. So eventually you realize, oh, I'm thinking about the future. I'm thinking about the past. I'm analyzing this situation. I'm having a conversation with myself. I'm fantasizing. I'm worrying, whatever it is. And then you just say thinking, and you come back to your breathing and you come back to your body. So you practice that over and over and over again. It's just like building your biceps, or, yeah, you know, you build this muscle, you cultivate your capacity to choose to bring your attention back to your breathing and back to your body and not be the victim of your thoughts. So that's how you basically start to take your power back. You take the reins back from a mind that's not disciplined, that a mind that is reactive and all over the place and typically quite confused. And then also obviously part of that journey is a lot of people say, oh, I can't meditate, or I'm a bad meditator. And that's also just the opposite of self-love or self-kindness. It's self-criticism and self-judgment, which is, again, what I've been talking about is the root cause of all of our problems. So eventually you treat the narrative of I can't meditate, or I'm bad at it, or comparing yourself and saying, oh, other people do it better. And you just say thinking. And so right, you treat that just like a thought. And you come back to your breathing and you come back to your body. And over time, you just do drop deeper and deeper and deeper into the deeper levels of consciousness inside of us. And part of the reason why people don't have as good of experiences is because the instruction is not that great. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is really like who you learn it from or where you learn it, because not all meditation is created equal. Not every teacher is as effective. Doesn't matter what they say or think. And someone could be amazing for your friend, but you might not resonate with them, you know?
Yeah.
And so.
Oh, I was going to ask you, what was your practice like? How often would you practice? How long typically? What was the progression of time? Because for me, you know, I started with, I used a couple different apps, Headspace, Waking Up. Right. And I consistently meditated for almost 2 years. The longest I ever did was like a 2-hour session, but that, you know, it was like afterwards, I was like, oh my God. I had some, you know, the practice really helped, just doing it consistently every day. But, I never really, it always felt like something to check off a to-do list, you know, like one of those people who are just meditating, like, all right, I meditated today. I went to the gym. I feel good about myself, that sort of thing. Right. And,
Did you do it because you were struggling mentally? What was your motive, your motivation?
I was struggling mentally a bit. I just kind of felt a little bit, just a lot of what I would describe as like, disempowering thoughts or just annoying, like, you know, shit popping in my head all the time. You know, it was after like 3 years of pretty heavy partying. And I just noticed that I was like, all right, my baseline like level of happiness is way down from what it was before all the partying and the drugs. So I'm guessing, you know, maybe meditation could bring it back up. And I felt like it did, in conjunction with, you know, a lot of other stuff I was doing to make myself more healthy, eating better, working out, journaling, you know, talking to a therapist, those sorts of things.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So two, you know, for me, I would say, for those 2 years, did you use that same program or different programs?
I used Headspace. I would just basically do like timed, you know, 10, 20 minute meditations. And then I used another app called Waking Up. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, I do. I know Headspace, but I think they're great. They're great bridges.
Totally. They're great. And Waking Up is Sam Harris. That's his app.
Oh, yeah. I know Sam. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And cool. He has a lot of good instruction on, you know, basically like, you know, a lot of guided meditation on just ways to see consciousness from different viewpoints and kind of like the reason behind meditation. So that was really good too. I just kind of lost the practice around like August of 2020. Got into a new exciting relationship and just like, I don't have time. I'm having a good time and everything's great. I don't need to meditate anymore, but you're inspiring me a bit to get back to it. So,
well, it's funny, you know, when I teach, so going back to your question and then coming full circle to this point, when I started, I started at first, you know, with probably 20 minutes, you know, get in first thing in the morning. I found that to be what I needed, because waking up with my, all my crazy thoughts and really being anxious and paralyzed, like not knowing what to do with my day or how to go about it in the right way. I mean, I was in a really bad place when I found meditation. And so it just training my mind and sitting there. And then, you know, the metaphor that your thoughts and your mind are like wild horse or wild horses, you know, I'd wake up and those wild horses, they were out of the gate and they were off, and they were, there were 12 of them. It's like I was at the racetrack, you know, and they're off in all these different directions. And I'm already feeling anxious and spread thin, you know, before I even get out of bed, sometimes even before my eyes are open. And so I would just get up and just sit. Like, it was like, I need to do this right now, because I didn't have anything else to grasp onto anymore. I had nothing. Like I had nobody and I had nothing. And so this was the only thing that helped me. So I became really addicted to it. So it started with 20 minutes, probably for the first couple of months, but then I went deep. I was like doing an hour every morning for years, sometimes 2 hours, because literally it was the only thing that made me feel good. I would do that in the morning. And then when I was done, I'd get up and I'd be in my space. And I'd be like, oh, I'm okay. I actually just felt okay being alive, instead of confused and anxious. Like, I got to figure out my life. I got to do this. What am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? And if I don't get it done by this point, you know, and then all of a sudden it was just like, I'm okay. And like, yeah. I can just go about my day and just one step at a time. And so it gave me that feeling and the power to get to that place inside of myself. So I really started to build my life around it, because it was the only thing that mattered to me. You know, nobody else was there for me. The drugs that were my best friend were not there for me anymore. You know, the food that I turned to, all these things that I had turned to, they weren't there for me anymore. So meditation became my new best friend. At that point, I still wasn't my best friend. I was still my own worst enemy, but meditation became my best friend. And so
avoid not becoming, so my friend who I mentioned, he told me, he's like, I can just sit for 4 hours in total bliss. And I feel great. He's like, when I'm not meditating, you know, similar to kind of what you said. And my question, you know, to him was like, so why not just do that all the time? Obviously you gotta, you know, you gotta live, make money, survive and all that stuff. But yeah, does the addiction kind of come full circle to the point where you can just get lost in meditation?
I think people can. It never went that way for me. In the spiritual community, there's a term called spiritual bypassing. And that's what I would put that in that category, spiritual bypassing. It's like, I want to avoid life. It's when people talk about the concept of ascension, for example, mm-hmm. It's like, I don't think we came here to get out of here. We came here to enjoy being alive. That's the whole thing. How do I figure out how to enjoy being in a body and being a human or a soul or whatever you believe you are, being a life in a body, and enjoy it without destroying yourself or hurting the people around you? So how do you make the most of this life in a body? And it's okay to have pleasure and joy, but like the chocolate cake, you don't need so much, you know? It's like, so for me, thankfully, I never fell into that camp, because I had this drive inside of me. It was just, I've always had this instinctual drive, just to be alive, to live well, and to have the best life I could, to navigate, you know, being in this time and place. You know, you're in a certain culture and a certain time and a certain place, which comes with a subset of challenges and adaptations. And then if you believe that there's an eternal part of you, your soul, your spirit, that has lived forever or reincarnated, or, you know, everybody's got different beliefs, you've got to merge the timeless with this place and this time. And so for me, I always felt those two forces, and I was always trying to figure out, how do I align them so that I don't feel like I'm at war with myself? And so ironically, part of that process for me was being an athlete. I was always used to feeling really good in my body, and I knew what it was like to feel strong, and I knew what it was like to move through the world fast and in the flow, right? You know, that word people flow use, state. Like, yeah, right, I'm in the flow, right? So I know that feeling in myself.
Yeah.
And so eventually I discovered Qigong, which has become a really big part of my life. It's similar to Tai Chi, and it's actually the foundation of Tai Chi, and it's the foundation for all of Chinese medicine. And what it does is, and the form that I teach now in all my events is it, I help people unlock. I take you through all the joints in the body, starting at the toes. And we literally unlock all the capillaries. So the circulation system, all the blood vessels and all the energy channels that an acupuncturist would use acupuncture needles to open up the flow of energy in your body. Mm-hmm. So I methodically take people through opening up all the joints, all the blood vessels, all the energy channels that we can access ourselves and methodically open up the whole system. So all your blood, all your energy and all your emotion starts to flow again. And the reason why this is so important and instinctually why I discovered it is because your body, our body is the subconscious mind. So all that pain, all the guilt, all the shame, all the fear, all the insecurity, all your secrets, right? It's all stored inside of our bodies. You know, all the stuff we didn't get out, where did it go? Well, it's in your legs and it's in your torso. It's right. In your cells throughout your whole body.
The issues are in the tissues, right?
Exactly. So that's why in yoga was always preparation for meditation. You prepare the body to be able to sit in meditation so that your blood and your energy can flow properly while you're sitting. So Qigong was a very similar practice in the Orient that prepared the body to open up the flow of energy, to open up the flow of blood so that everything inside of you was flowing freely. So I became really addicted to Qigong, and that became this complementary relationship with my meditation practice, which is part of what I teach people, because you want to be able to sit in stillness, but we all want to, and I wanted to bring that stillness into my life. So for me, the bridge was to have a moving meditation, a moving form of meditation, so that I became that mindful with my body and my movement in the world when I wasn't sitting on a cushion or on a chair doing meditation. So now that became kind of my resting state of consciousness. So when I'm sitting here, I'm totally aware of my breath. I'm aware of my body. I'm aware of my surroundings. I love going to the gym again now. I go to the gym and I go slow and I listen to my body, and you know, it's like a meditation for me. So basically when this becomes a value and a priority in your life, it becomes a way of life. So it's not just like something you do right in the morning. It becomes your way of being. And for me, I needed it and I wanted it. And the more I tasted it, the more I wanted it. And I wanted to build my life around it. And so that's really, I built my whole life, a whole business traveling the world, teaching people how to find this place inside of themselves. Because for me, it's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it progressed. But the physical side, the moving meditation was very important for me. So I don't know if
That's Qigong?
Qigong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of Qigong and Tai Chi, and I've seen it demonstrated a few times, but never really understood, the workings of it. It's kind of like a buzzword, basically. But yeah, I'm curious how it ties into meditation and yoga, and obviously it's cool as your, former football player, how that ties in as well, because usually associate that sort of thing with like a certain archetype, and it's not going to be a football player. So it's cool to see that bridge there.
Totally. Yeah. But what's ironic is that elite athletes right now, they learn meditation and yoga because it does increase your performance. And so, so my recommendation across the board is, again, it's just like everything, not all forms of Qigong, for example, are created equal, and not all teachers teach a very effective form because there's all these fancy movements and fancy forms, and people get real caught up in how fancy it is, and that doesn't mean it's effective. And so, but as a blanket statement, when you're doing these types of practice, the slower and the gentler, the better. So like for example, I prefer yin yoga, so you can take your time and go slow. And if you're in a class, you're not like anxious trying to keep up with everybody and keep up with the teacher, because that defeats the purpose. Yeah, you want to go slow.
I'm doing yoga.
Right.
Feel I go to all these yoga classes and this is everyone's laughing at me. I'm like,
So yin yoga. If you need a class, look for yin, because that's slow and gentle. So in this space, less is more, and like the Taoist saying that water wears away rock. It's that gentle movement where your consciousness, your awareness is in the part of the body that you're moving, that actually opens up the stuck flow of energy, that opens up the stuck flow of blood. But if you don't have enough time and space to be in that state of consciousness, it can be counterproductive, actually. So it's like our culture, right? The joke, like, I'm rushing to get to yoga. I'm rushing to get to my meditation class. It's counterproductive. Like, to have road rage and saying fuck you to the person at the stoplight so you can get to yoga and meditation defeats the purpose, you know? Like,
So that could be a great stand-up comedy bit, by the way.
So I was on my way to meditation. I pulled up to this fucking asshole who wouldn't, you know.
This is fucking great. Totally. I mean, that's yeah. You know, and then you hear people talking about, you know, you hear like, oh, people like, oh, you need to do more meditation, or you need to do, you know, the silly, ridiculous kind of shaming in some of these spiritual elite communities. Oh. You see it a lot in Tulum.
I'm sure. Yeah. If you're listening, don't buy into any of that. And I think, you know, the metaphor I love is meditation is a raft. Mm-hmm. It's not the destination, right? What is the destination, right? Where do we want to get to? We want to get to life in the present moment, and we want to be at peace, mm-hmm. and we want to feel good, and we want to feel inspired. We want to feel healthy. And so meditation is the raft. You know, you don't want to be stuck on the raft in the ocean forever, right? You want to get somewhere. So where are we trying to get? Well, ultimately, it's to that place where you feel good about yourself and your life, and you're kind. And you're of benefit to the people around you. So, you know, I sometimes joke the spiritual ego is the worst type of ego. And sure. So, you know, to use your spiritual practice as a way to judge and put people down is just kind of the worst side of the ego, because it thinks, right, it's this part of ourselves that thinks it's better than, because it does this, this, and this. And that's very confused.
Right.
Yeah. So you don't have to, the thing is we're all, if you believe in God or you believe in the universe, we are all already that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do anything to be more of that, but you do have to try some things if you don't want to be dysfunctional. Sure. And you don't want to have, because I think most human beings have a very sick mind. And mm-hmm. if you want to make your sick mind a healthy mind, you need to work on it. And one other koan that came to mind as we were talking with about the drugs earlier is I love this koan. When I teach with people and I talk with people, I always say, we use words to describe our true nature, who we really are, our essence. To me, some of the most accurate words are energy, right? We could say our soul, our spirit, who we really are, or even just this life inside of us is energy, because that's a scientific fact, right? It's atoms vibrating at a certain frequency. And some people think that those atoms have consciousness, right? We have conscious awareness. So you could say we're consciousness. So we're energy, we're consciousness. And kind of like you described with your situation now in your relationship, I think that one word that comes really close to who we are is that I think we are pure love. I think that's one word, like love and pure love, that's our essence. I think a lot of, when I, you know, I'm with a group of people and I say, you know, when do you feel the most like yourself? And a lot of people agree that when their heart is open and they're giving and receiving love with a partner or family or friends, and there's no fear, there's no inhibition, they feel the most like themselves. Does that resonate with you?
Totally. Yeah.
And so I think that points to who and what we really are, our essence, our true self.
Yeah.
So then I like to say, how could love, if your true nature is love, how could love not love itself?
Good question. Yeah.
How could love not love itself? So how could any part of love not be love? And so all those parts of us, all those thoughts, all those reactions, all that pain, that whole category of our experience represents the lessons that we need to learn and see clearly to get back to looking at life from our true nature. Mm-hmm. And so I came up when you were talking about the MDMA, mm-hmm. because it's like that person that was unlocked, right? We're in there. He's in there.
Sure.
He was covered up by limiting belief, pain, you know, conditioning. And we all have our own limiting beliefs, our own pain, our own conditioning that we have to unlearn so that we can just be who we really are instead of what our school taught us or our religion taught us or our parents taught us. And so for me, meditation is a raft for that, to untie all the knots, you know, to liberate ourselves from everything that's not real, that's not healthy, that's not true. And that's what meditation is to me. And so because I'm hungry to be as free as I can be in this life, I want to do what I want, when I want, with who I want, where I want, and feel great the whole time. Meditation is a technique that gets me there. So, you know, I want to just devour it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How does, what's your take on enlightenment and how that kind of fits in? That's another buzzword that I've, you know, heard thrown around sometimes, people from an egotistical place, like, I'm enlightened, you're not. I'm like, that's got to be the antithesis of what enlightenment is, but I don't know. So, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a Taoist saying that I love that goes, those who say don't know, and those who know don't say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're enlightened, you're not going to walk around saying you're enlightened.
Right.
Because there's no need to, right? So, because if you're enlightened, you're just going to like want to have your tea or be in your garden or mm-hmm. be with your lover or whatever it is that makes you be wonderful to be alive, you know, feel wonderful to be alive. You're not going to have time for anything else.
Right.
So it goes back to the same conversation that it's a, you know, all these things are a raft and what's the destination. And if the destination is enlightenment, which I think is synonymous with what we've been saying, which is really full of light, full mm-hmm. of love for our being to be full of light and full of love. That's health. That's happiness. That's enjoying your days and your life and the people you spend your time with and being kind and being compassionate and being true to yourself. And I think we've grown up and the spiritual community has, there's been this kind of like, well, this is not the spiritual world and community. And this is the spiritual world and community, but it's all spirit. It's all God. It's all the universe. It's all, there's no separation. That is dualistic thinking. And enlightenment is a state of non-dual thinking where everything is embraced as this one living organism, you know, this one interdependent connected, you know, system of energy and life. And so I think it manifests itself practically as kindness, mm-hmm. as love, as understanding, as authenticity, not as egotistical, I'm better than, not, you know, so I think there's a lot of confusion around it. And a lot of it is tied up with what I mentioned earlier of this concept of spiritual bypassing, because a lot of people use meditation and spiritual practices and substances like, for example, ayahuasca to avoid themselves and mm-hmm. to avoid their pain. Because sometimes it's a lot easier to go live in an ashram or somewhere in the world that is like a spiritual place and, or go take a substance that helps you access certain states of consciousness. It's a lot easier sometimes to do that than to tell your mother or your father what you're really feeling.
For sure.
Or tell your girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or wife that you feel scared or insecure or that you're questioning the relationship. So those are the biggest leaps of faith in our life, is saying, I feel hurt or I feel confused or I don't know what I want anymore or I love you, I have feelings for you. Like those true expressions of your most vulnerable heart and soul is the hardest thing to do, but one of the signs of enlightenment is that type of vulnerability and honesty, and then kindness and integrity, the virtues that someone would embody, you know, like I think kindness, integrity, compassion, you know, non-reactivity, so peace. Mm-hmm. So we, it's easy to make enlightenment this concept that I can just like go, if I meditate for long enough, or I take this yoga teacher training, or I take this meditation teacher training, or
right, you know, doing a ayahuasca,
right, or Amma puts her head on, hugs me, or the Dalai Lama puts his hand on me, or whatever, that all of a sudden I won't have to deal with all the shit that comes with being human.
Right.
Well, guess what? There's no escaping it. That's why the Buddha said life is suffering, because that's one part of being human, is the suffering we have to deal with. Our suffering and the suffering of loved ones, the suffering of being in a body, of aging, of dying, of regret, of learning the hard way. But so to me, enlightenment is not running from it, but how do I meet this head on, face life head on, and make the most of it, given that, you know, all these things are true and they're hard to juggle, but how do I do this in the most authentic, loving, kind way possible, so that when I go to bed at night and then I wake up in the morning, I look at myself in the mirror, that I respect myself. I think for me, like, success and enlightenment, a lot of it comes down to self-respect. You know, respect yourself for who you are, how you are, deep in you, you know, that's between you and the universe.
Totally.
And only you know that, right?
Yeah.
People listening, we know. And even if we don't, we spend the whole day running from it. There's
right.
that 1 second where you have that honest acknowledgement with yourself in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point. That's where enlightenment is real or not. Mm. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really great way to say it, for sure. Cause yeah, you can't hide from that truth. It's just there, you know?
No. And no. You could have, and I've gone through this in myself. You could have millions of followers. You know, you could be a guru, you could be a saint, but that doesn't mean that deep in the depths of your mind and your heart and your soul, that you're 100% at peace with yourself. You might've built up a huge thing, you know, for
yeah.
some reason. You might be a very powerful, special soul, but that doesn't mean that deep in your heart and soul, you have made total peace with everything.
Yeah.
And so that's enlightenment. It has nothing to do with anybody else. It has nothing to do with me saying I'm enlightened, or even you thinking I'm enlightened. It has nothing to do with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see it all the time with, you know, you see these guys that get incredibly successful in their field, whether it's finance, like a guy like Bernie Madoff, you know, he was insanely wealthy and successful, you know, before he got into the whole pyramid scheme thing. And it's just like, have to have more, seeking this, you know, being, I don't know, this climbing this mountain, you're never going to get up. And then gambling and losing everything because of it. So yeah, it's kind of like, you know, having the ability to know when, you know, you become totally addicted to it, I guess. Oh, and that was my other question. So when, you know, how often do you meditate now? What's your kind of practice when it comes to Qigong, and what would you recommend for someone who wants to get into these sort of things, like a roadmap on how to do that?
So starting with myself first, I would say for over 10 years, every day I was so disciplined with these practices, and they really became my life.
Mm-hmm.
Again, but not because I had no agenda. All I wanted to do was feel good. So I just did what felt good. So I did these things. I went to work. I did these things. I studied. That's all I wanted to do, because nothing else felt good to me, you know?
Right.
And so for many years, they were my everything. And what happened through that process was that I reconditioned my nervous system, and I rewired my brain through training my mind in this way, through using my body in this way. And so thankfully, and that's the harvest of this type of labor. When you put in that type of work, the harvest is that it becomes your resting state of consciousness. It's not just something you do. It becomes who you are. And so it's kind of like in the beginning, desperate times call for desperate measures. Like, you need to be more disciplined. You need to be more extreme. But then as time goes on, you don't need as much to get there. So for example, I can just take a deep breath right now and focus on my breathing and drop into that state of consciousness immediately. I don't need time to get there. So now how it manifests is when I wake up in the morning, I just feel my body. I focus on breathing. I don't sit for long periods of time on a regular basis like I used to. Mm-hmm. But I move, you know, I move pretty slow at a lot of different points of the day. It's like when I'm moving because I got to move, I move. But if I'm not moving, I'm in stillness. Mm-hmm. And so, so I do start the day with breathing. And then Qigong is the same. It used to be something I was addicted to and did every day for hours, for years, and now not so much. So through, and again, that goes back to my extreme personality. So through the years of doing all that, coming back to today, when I work with people, I say, just start with 10 minutes of meditation in the morning. That's really all you need to get started. But you got to set yourself up to succeed. And how you do that is, you do it first thing in the morning before you do anything else, except for go to the restroom or get some water. But before coffee, before reading your phone, before really even talking to anybody, you should get up and sit on a chair or sit on a floor or sit up in your bed. And if it's, let's say, 8 o'clock in the morning, set your alarm for 8:10. And because I know how the mind works, I also recommend you set the alarm for 8:11, 8:12, 8:13 and 8:14. Cause what will happen is you'll be sitting in meditation and you'll be like, did I set the alarm? And then you'll look at your phone and that's your excuse not to meditate. So we got to get ourselves over our own BS.
Right.
Like, well, I was just looking to see, I set the alarm. No bullshit. That's your monkey mind that we're trying to work with. Totally. So set at least 3 or 4 alarms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, no, I set 4. One of those 4 is going off. Okay. So you set 10 minutes and then 11 minutes and 12 minutes and 13 minutes and you put your phone down, make sure it's on airplane mode. And you sit and you focus on your breathing and your body. And I recommend breathing through your nose. And when you start to think, you say the word thinking, and you can be thinking about anything or talking to yourself about anything, just any active thinking or conversation with yourself, you say the word thinking. And often people get to the point where they're like, I'm saying thinking, because their mind just doesn't stop, which is so natural at the beginning. So you're not doing anything wrong and you're not bad at it. It's just your mind has inertia. Your thoughts have inertia. It's like a law of physics. And the way energy flows in your head has inertia. So you need to, it takes time. It's like you throw a ball. It's going to take time to slow down. So at first you're going to be thinking. And you don't need to say thinking literally every second. You can just say thinking, take some deep breaths, notice that your mind is powerful and that it wants to keep going in a certain direction. And then say thinking, come back to your breathing, come back to your body. And that's all you do. You just keep coming back to your breathing and your body. And it's so simple and so non-fancy. Like, I'm not giving you a mantra that you think is going to make you enlightened, like TM. Mm-hmm. And I'm not having you visualize all your chakras. And right. I'm not having you visualize Buddha or Jesus or Mother Mary or whatever other deity or teacher you like. And the reason, and I'm not having you listen to music, and this is all really important, because nothing can ever substitute for training your mind at the core of your mind. And this is how you start to do it. And music, visualizations, a mantra is all one layer above this deep layer of actually training your mind at the core of your mind, where your thoughts actually bubble out of nothing. They come from your consciousness and they bubble out of nothing, or your subconscious and they bubble up. You have to get familiar with that source, where the thought begins, where it takes shape, where it goes to the future, where it goes to fear, where it goes to fantasy, instead of just being with your breath and your body. And nothing can or will ever substitute it for it. So it's the most difficult. It's the simplest, the most difficult, but the most powerful. And so for people listening, just 10 minutes is all you need. Just every day, 10 minutes in the morning. And you can do more if you want to, but 10 minutes is enough. And then the other thing that this does is, I'm sure a lot of people listening, and I'm sure you're familiar with The Secret, and the idea that your thoughts create your reality. Well, they do. So the thoughts you think when you wake up in the morning go out energetically like dominoes, and they set in motion your day. So when you wake up in the morning and you don't do anything for your mind and your thoughts are all over the place and you're scattered and you're anxious and you're thinking about a million different things, even if you think you're okay, well, guess what? You're going to live the day chasing those thoughts. You're going to be all over the place chasing those 10,000 things that were just flowing through your consciousness. Whereas if you do this for 10 minutes, you're going to start with this really clear blank slate. And it's going to be like, what do I really want? Mm-hmm. What do I really want to focus on? What do I really need or want to give my attention to? And then you become much more deliberate, focused, and effective at whatever you're doing, because you're doing what you're doing with all of your being instead of just a fraction of your energy. Yeah. And so that's the other thing, is this gives you the power to create and shape your reality much more than anything else. So that's kind of like, you know, the Joseph Campbell quote, "The cave you fear holds the treasure you seek." So if you're afraid of facing yourself and really looking at your mind and being with yourself, well, the treasure you're missing out on is not just the peace, not just the feeling good, but also the power. It's like a superpower that we all have to literally imagine, create and shape our lives exactly how we want. But if we are the victim of our thoughts and don't do this and just run through the day tortured by our mind or controlled by our mind instead of taking our reins back, we'll never realize how much power we have to create something that feels good, that we want, instead of just thinking, oh, life just brings me X, Y, and Z, instead of realizing that I'm actually attracting and creating X, Y, and Z because that's what I'm giving my attention to, or I'm not sticking up for myself, or I'm not following my heart, or I'm letting my fear stop me, all because we're not aware of this subtle dynamic because we're not looking at it first thing in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, shit, if everyone were to do that and take those 10 minutes before doing everything else, the world would be a much different place. And
so much better.
My God. Yeah. Because exactly as you described, you know, you wake up and those dominoes go out. I like that metaphor. And yeah, you're just off to the races and you get a bad text. You know, the first thing you look at your phone, you see some annoying text come in and it just sets the tone for the rest of the day.
Exactly. So, yeah. Or the news or right. Or your emails, right. Whatever it is that, and the whole thing is there really is, there's no excuse for not taking 10 minutes. There just isn't. And I've worked with, that's why I focus on this, because there's just no excuse. The only excuse is your own bullshit. So you got to, it's like, you want to, not you, I'm saying in general, anybody, you want to keep making excuses. Well, guess what? It's your fucking life. It's going to suck if you keep making excuses. 10 minutes, stop making excuses. And so I work with a lot of parents too. So I'll say, go lock yourself in the bathroom if you have to. Lock yourself in the bathroom. Get earplugs. Mm-hmm. Just go in the bathroom with a blanket. Sit on the toilet. Sit on the floor with a blanket or cushion. Put on earplugs and take 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's right. That's the only valid, oh, my kids, my partner. Yeah, I get it. But take 10 minutes. Just go in the bathroom. 10 minutes.
That's it. 10 minutes. Yeah, man, it's really, really good applicable advice.
That's why we book a flight to India, because we think I can't take 10 minutes in the bathroom. So I got to go to India, right? And I got to go to the ashram, and I got to, right? That's the Eat, Pray, Love. That's what Elizabeth Gilbert did. And that's why so many people resonated with it.
Totally.
But she didn't know how to take 10 minutes probably in the bathroom.
Ten minutes. Dude, it's been so awesome having you on. How can people find more, learn about your work, get your book, all that stuff?
Well, I think the most helpful thing is on Amazon. Mm-hmm. You Were Not Born to Suffer. It's in every format, and that's the most helpful thing. And it's, sometimes, people feel like getting help is too expensive, but that's also an excuse. So I highly recommend people pick up the book, because it's helped a lot of people that weren't finding help from doctors, from psychiatrists, from, a lot of spiritual or self-help work. So that I'd say there, and then I'm on all the social media.
Okay.
So.
Awesome. Well, it's been, an amazing conversation. I've learned a ton. I'm
sure. Oh, cool.
Too. So thanks for coming on and sharing all your wisdom.
Oh, Robbie, thanks for having me. It was wonderful to talk.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.